and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the refugee crisis on Turkey's southern border with Syria, where local Kurdish families are fleeing from an offensive by the Islamic State, or ISIL. Asla Bali, a professor at the UCLA School of Law, where she teaches international law, international human rights, and the laws of war, joins us to discuss whether Turkey will adopt a more aggressive posture towards ISIL now that Turkey's diplomats held hostage by the Islamic State have been released, and how Turkey will cope with the influx of 130,000 refugees in recent days on top of the more than 200,000 Syrian refugees already living in camps on the border. Then we'll get an update on the UN Climate Summit underway in New York and speak with Cleo Pascal, who is a fellow at the Royal Institute for International Affairs, Chatham House, London, and a consultant to the US Department of Energy, NATO, and the OSCE. She is the author of Global Warring: How Environmental, Economic, and Political Crises Will Redraw the World Map, and has been engaged in climate diplomacy in the Pacific on behalf of endangered island nations facing extinction from rising sea levels. We'll discuss why the first and third biggest emitters of greenhouse gases, China and India, are not sending their heads of state to the summit, which President Obama will address on Tuesday. Then finally, we'll examine how the Koch brothers are radically increasing their donations to American universities, in particular targeting economics departments with grants to hire professors who share the Koch's libertarian philosophy and will teach courses on economic freedom. Connor Gibson, a member of Greenpeace's investigations team, who is the co-author of Greenpeace's new report, Koch Pollution on Campus, Academic Freedom Under Assault from Charles Koch's $50 million campaign to infiltrate higher education. He joins us to discuss how Koch investments in universities have skyrocketed from just 7 universities in 2005 to 254 today. And joining us now is Asla Bali, who's a professor at the UCLA School of Law, where she teaches courses on public international law, international human rights, and the laws of war. She is the author of Courts and Constitutional Transition, Lessons from the Turkish Case, and Negotiating Nonproliferation, International Law and Delegation in the Iranian Nuclear Crisis. Welcome to Background Briefing, Asla Bali.
Thank you so much for having me.
And there is a crisis on the Turkish-Syrian border with an influx of 130,000 refugees in recent days from Kurdish villages under attack by ISIL or the Islamic State. And this, of course, means that on top of the more than 200,000 Syrian refugees already living in these camps on the border, Turkey has more of a refugee crisis than they had on their hands before. What explains ISIS's or ISIL's strategy here? Wouldn't they not want to provoke Turkey? And now that the Islamic State has given up the Turkish diplomatic hostages, Turkey is more free to retaliate.
Yes. I think that it's an interesting question. One thing that's worth keeping in mind is that we still don't really know the terms on which the 49 Turkish diplomats and their family members were released. So we don't really know whether there was an agreement or what was exchanged or how that release came about. And so it's very hard to know what ISIL's strategy might be against the backdrop of this sort of information deficit about what their strategy was to begin with. Why take such a large number of diplomatic hostages that happened, the hostage taking happened in June? Why hold them for this period of time? Why keep them alive? Why treat them desperately? And why ultimately release them? So it's a little hard to work out from what's known in the public record exactly what that relationship looks like. But I'm not sure that ISIL, ISIS, IS, whatever we might call them, believe that their attacks on this Kurdish town in Syria, which at least in Syrian is known as Ain al-Arabon, and perhaps Kobane or Kobane in Kurdish, that they think of that as a provocation against Turkey. Certainly the flow of refugees into Turkey is going to be something of a very significant security concern for Turkey, 130,000 people at once, the kind of incredible needs that such a large influx all in one period is going to produce, especially as winter is coming and so on. But the idea that that might provoke Turkey into taking military action against the IS group, when Turkey thus far has essentially decided to remain what appears to be neutral as between the different rebel forces striking Syria, striking the Assad regime, and very aggressively opposed to the Assad regime itself, I think maybe the calculation of the Islamic State here is that this won't necessarily tip the Turkish position. Now, Turkey insists, and it's true, that it had designated an earlier iteration of what is today calling itself the so-called Islamic State, but a much earlier iteration of the same sets of groups had already been condemned and designated a terrorist organization as early as 2005 by the Turks when they were operating in Iraq. And so Turkey says, well, we've always maintained that this is a terrorist organization. We don't do any business with terrorist organizations and so on. But with the usual logic of the enemy of my enemy, it's not clear that Turkey has taken an aggressive position against the Islamic State, and it's not clear that they are prepared to going forward.
But in these recent conferences to organize a regional coalition against the Islamic State, in Jeddah, Turkey was the odd man out, didn't sign the communique, and in Paris, where I think 26 nations, including Russia and China, met, Turkey again didn't show up. So what's going on there? I mean, they've already made a pretty conspicuous absence of not wanting to be a part of this coalition, but it's right on their doorstep. It's hard to believe that they aren't concerned about it.
Yes. Well, of course, the reasons that they gave at those previous meetings was the fate of the 49 Turkish diplomatic and security personnel that were being held hostage. But now we have the end of the hostage crisis as of this weekend, and the question is, will this portend a change of policy? And the challenge is that, you know, Turkey has an extensive border with Syria. It has very many competing interests in Syria at present. And while it's true that many other countries, including the 10 countries that you pointed to that signed in Jeddah, in other words, many of the Arab countries that also have important stakes in the outcome in Syria have signed on, their signing on to any particular agreement doesn't quite have the same meaning as Turkey, as a NATO country signing on. I mean, the expectations of Turkey, the demands on Turkey, the military mobilization that Turkey would likely have to engage in is substantially greater than anything that the Arab 10 Arab states have signed on to if Turkey decided to fully join this coalition. It's really the frontline NATO country in a coalition that is essentially being run by the United States, its NATO ally, and the West, although with some support from the Arab world. If there was truly extensive support in the Arab world, I think the Islamic State would be in genuine trouble, since much of its financing and arms are flowing through support from the Gulf. And so even as Gulf governments sign up to this agreement, it's not clear exactly how extensive their commitments are going to be. And I think Turkey is quite conscious that if it were to sign up, it would have to do so in a way that would engage it very directly and therefore potentially invite genuine destabilization within Turkey itself, which borders directly on and has a very long border, I believe over 500-kilometer long border with Syria. So Turkey finds itself in a difficult situation where, on the one hand, it's certainly not affiliating itself by any stretch with the Islamic State, although it has explicitly affiliated itself with other rebel forces on the ground in Syria that are either not competing directly with the Islamic State or that have made some kind of de facto common cause in their attempt to rid Syria of the Assad regime, a goal that Turkey shares with those other rebel groups. So on the one hand, it's in a tenuous position with respect to its own interests in regime change in Syria. And on the other hand, it worries that its commitment would involve a much greater military role for Turkey than any of the 10 Arab states or other states in the region would possibly be required to provide. And I think the countries to which Turkey should be best compared are really Iraq and Jordan and Lebanon, in terms of countries with substantial borders with Syria, where they have already faced a degree of destabilization, where they have absorbed very large refugee populations, and when they have a level of sort of skin in the game, if you like, that if Syria were to be badly destabilized or the security situation fall further out of control, they will absorb the immediate cost of that in a way that the United States or NATO countries in Europe or even the Gulf countries don't have the same kind of immediacy of consequences within their own borders. So I do think there's a lot that's being taken into account here, and one way of understanding the Turkish position is to understand that for them to fully commit would involve a much greater commitment than that which has been forthcoming from other countries in the region.
So already there have been some demonstrations from young Kurdish men throwing rocks at Turkish border police who are preventing them from going back into Syria to join the PKK to fight against the Islamic State or ISIL. And I can understand why the Turks are leery of that. How much is that complicating things? The PKK, which I think is nothing like it used to be, Turkey has good relations with the Turkish, with the new Kurdish Republic in the north of Iraq. And clearly, the U.S. has got to be saying to Turkey, you know, please, can we use the NATO base at Incirlik?
Yes, I do think it plays a role. So, for example, just as 130,000 Kurds were being allowed in at the border over the weekend, you also had security clashes elsewhere in the country with Kurdish activists that were basically attacking Turkish security forces, protesting what they view as an insufficient support for their strategy in Syria. And so there is, first of all, the very large Kurdish population within Turkey that Turkey has to manage its relations with, which has just been augmented dramatically by the arrival of tens of thousands of additional Kurdish members of the Kurdish community from Syria. Of course, it's completely appropriate that Turkey allow all those refugees in. But attention in what's being asked by Washington and by NATO allies is, you're saying keep this 560-mile border open for the arrival of refugees, but seal it and keep it completely closed for the travel of rebels back into Syria, because the fear is that together with Kurdish fighters that might be seeking to join the PKK, you're also going to have all forms of Islamist brands coming in and out of Turkey across the border if you allow resupply to take place through that border. So Turkey is being asked to manage a very difficult situation. On the one hand, help the Kurdish fighters. On the other hand, bring in all the Kurdish refugees. On the third hand, seal the border completely and make it impossible for Islamists to travel back and forth. It's a very large border. These identities are in flux, to say the least, volatile. It's extremely difficult to know exactly what this would mean. Add to that, add to the Kurdish issue domestically, add to the difficulty of managing a border of this size and the demands, conflicting demands on the Turkish government in terms of allow the refugees in but don't let the rebels out. You then also have the fact of the smuggling economy and the fact that this Syria and Iraq both border on the part of Turkey that has been historically least well-developed, most restive, is the homeland of the Kurdish community of Turkey, and which has survived on a basically smuggling economy through the last 20 years. Why? Because for 12 years, Turkey was required to maintain sanctions against Iraq, which left only a black market available with the Iraqi border. And then almost within 5 years of the Iraqi border being reopened once the United States had established its own control in Iraq, we had the closure of the Syrian border, again, under for trade, under international pressure. And so that region, by virtue of its relationship to the borders with both Iraq and Syria, has been directly harmed by international management strategies of the conflicts in that area. And to say to Turkey now, cut off the smuggling, seal the border also to the trade that IS is certainly benefiting from, is to say, once again, push this region domestically in your own country into penury and into immigration. And that's also a challenge. So there are so many competing factors that Turkey has to take into account. And on the other hand, are the groups that are asking for this assistance. First, the United States, with its bungled management strategy in Iraq, which produced many of the factors that are now leading to the instability in the region, asking Turkey to now sign on to a new strategy with respect to Syria that shows few signs of being more credible in terms of producing any kind of a secure, stable outcome in Syria than the commitments from 2003 in Iraq, which, of course, Turkey had also declined to participate in. So you have a pretty poor track record for the country that's leading this new strategy. You have a set of significant competing interests and a very large portion of the country domestically in Turkey being affected by that border region. And it makes for a very difficult position, much more so, I would say, at least, than other NATO allies and then Gulf countries. So again, I think the comparable countries are Jordan, Lebanon, and Iraq, and you don't see any of them lining up in quite the same way that the Gulf is prepared to or that European allies are prepared to.
But of course, as you know, Aslam Ali, the president's been under a lot of criticism here in the United States for the lack of a strategy. He even said that they were working on one, which was obviously caused him a lot of grief. Presumably, though, what he's saying to some of these leaders, particularly the Turkish leader and other regional leaders, is, look, you know, this is your regional problem. You guys have got to step up. You know, you've already got skin on the in the game, whether you know it or not. Is that an argument that's going to fly? Or can you, you know, just blaming America for all the missteps, all of which I think makes sense and perhaps be reasonable. But on the other hand, who is really threatened by these people? I mean, here we are in the United States going into a third Iraq war, basically over the beheading of two Americans. At least at 9/11, they killed 3,000 people and attacked the Pentagon and Wall Street and almost hit the Capitol. So you can understand why the U.S. was upset then. But why are we so hysterical about ISIS now?
Well, I mean, to begin with, it's true, of course, what you say about September 11th and the consequences in the United States that led to a mood of being willing to enter into military response to those attacks. But of course, the military response that emerged had nothing to do with those attacks, but rather was after, you know, demoted the Afghanistan initiative and promoted instead an attack on Iraq, which was in no way related. And so just as then, now, we have come up with a strategy that seems actually quite removed from the genuine national security threats that the United States face. Just as al-Qaeda and not the Saddam Hussein regime were responsible for those attacks, here, however troubling the Islamic State may be for the regional actors, there's no reason to believe that it is, at present, an international franchise targeting the United States. Indeed, the Pentagon has said as much, as has the President and the State Department. All of them concede that, at present, there is no Islamic State threat against the United States as such, as opposed to, say, American citizens who find themselves in Syria or Iraq, but that they might in the future emerge as a threat, and so we've decided to make them public enemy number one. I think the reason the rest of the United States, the public, is willing to support this initiative is because of the monstrosity of the public theater that Islamic State has put out in its propaganda efforts through these beheadings, and that is horrifying, and the natural response of revulsion and desire for some kind of exaction of punishment for this behavior is understandable, but why that should amount to a reason that cooler heads and policymakers decide to engage in an all-out military attack is, I think, a really important question, and one that's not being asked, perhaps because of the proximity to midterm elections, perhaps because the mood in the country is critical of the Obama administration for not acting more quickly, and therefore the capacity to deliberate about this question, the timeline has been shortened. But whatever the reasons are, this seems strategically to be a mistaken approach. And for the actors in the region that, as you put it, have skin in the game, I think that's a real problem, because if you come up with a strategy that has very little prospect for addressing the problem, you're really not helping those actors in the region that face the problem, right? You may exacerbate the problem, or at best, you may, you know, have no effect on the problem, but you're not going to solve the problem through this strategy, in part because you have no commitment other than to strike. And what has already happened is, by virtue of the United States designating the Islamic State the sort of enemy number one, high-priority national security threat, and so forth, the Islamic State has managed to make itself a much more appealing entity. It seems like the most serious game in town. It seems as if it has much wider objectives than those related to Syria or Iraq. And you now have entities from the Maghreb to Afghanistan declaring that they are franchises of the Islamic State, which is an astonishing development for what is ultimately the sort of ragtag remainders of Saddam Hussein's decommissioned military, a consequence of our earlier intervention in Iraq, and various opponent groups of Assad that want to affiliate themselves with whichever is the most effective fighting force on the ground in a civil war in Syria. To transform that entity into a worldwide franchise was already a terrible, you know, unintended consequence of the policy priority setting in Washington, but it could get much worse. It could become the case that these groups are motivated not because they originally set out to target the United States, but because it enables them to recruit, it enables them to fundraise, to have this adversarial relationship, and as a result, they now may have a vested interest in also styling themselves as a principal national security threat to the United States, which is certainly the tail wagging the dog and a terrible outcome, I think, for a policy that's meant to address what is, at the end of the day, a relatively marginal problem from the perspective of Washington. Very important problem for certainly Damascus, Ankara, Baghdad, Amman, Beirut. But why and how exactly we've allowed it to be transformed into a reason for the United States to mobilize in this way, I think, is an important question that isn't being fully vetted.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today, Asleb Ali.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Asleb Ali, who's a professor at the UCLA School of Law, where she teaches courses on public international law, international human rights, and the laws of war. She is the author of Courts and Constitutional Transition, Lessons from the Turkish Case, and Negotiating Nonproliferation, International Law, and Delegation in the Iranian Nuclear Crisis. We're going to take a brief station break and get an update on the UN Climate Summit underway in New York. بعيونهم نوى النظرة رماني ثم اندحق علي نوى النظرة رماني جيت اني بجوز عيونه على صمار الحنطاوي Thank you. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Cleo Pascal, who specializes in the geopolitical security and economic implications of environmental change from global warming. She's a fellow with the Royal Institute of International Affairs, Chatham House, London, a consultant to the United States Department of Energy, NATO, and the OSCE, and was one of the three recipients of the 2010 awards of special merit from the Grantham Prize for her book, Global Warming: How Environmental, Economic, and Political Crises Will Redraw the World Map. Welcome to Background Briefing, Cleo Pascal.
A great pleasure.
And Cleo, you're in New York, and on Monday, a new report came out from the Global Carbon Project that finds that greenhouse gas emissions have jumped to new heights in 2013, with India alone increasing greenhouse emissions by 5%. And the U.S., which had actually gone down in its emissions, went up last year with an increase. So given that the world's first and third largest emitters of greenhouse gases, that's China and India respectively, will not be represented by their top leaders at this UN summit on climate change, what does that tell you?
Well, their approach is that what's going on at the UN is largely a trade deal as opposed to anything directly relevant for climate. So they're concerned that they would be forced to or asked to sign some sort of deal that would impose green tariffs, which would affect their exports. It would open them up to outsiders coming and taking a look at their industrial practices, those sorts of things. And unfortunately, the West hasn't built a lot of good faith with China and India through things like the nuclear deal with India, things like compulsory verification where they attempted to make that part of the deal. So even though there might be the best of intentions from sectors in the West and there might be willingness in India and China to do something about the problem, this particular mechanism creates a lot of concern from an economic perspective in India and China.
And is this issue falling into its old trap of the rift between the developed and developing countries? Is that what's happening at the UN?
Largely. There are a lot of, in many ways, that's coming into play. There are some unusual alliances, though, within that. So, for example, Germany, which has a very strong renewables technology sector, has a good relationship with a lot of the small island developing states who are concerned about the effects of climate change for obvious reasons. So individual countries within the West have managed to find common cause with some of those who are most affected by the causes. But in a broader sense, the kind of deals that are being proposed, these compulsory deals, which would include verification, those sorts of things, are viewed with enormous suspicion by countries like India and China, who will say, we're not against decarbonizing, but we just want to do it within our own country. We want to set up our own carbon markets. We don't want the money to go to Wall Street or the city. You know, we will switch to renewables for our own energy security reasons anyway. We just don't want to get tied into something that will have unintended economic consequences for us.
But so far, this has been an excuse for inaction, this rift between the developing and the developed nations. And is that game still being played, or is there a way? Obviously, Ban Ki-moon is trying to jumpstart this whole thing into a new dynamic and a new paradigm. And, of course, the title of this UN summit is Catalyzing Action. Is that still at play, that, in other words, an excuse to do nothing?
Well, there are a lot of people that are doing all sorts of different nothing. So if you're in the developing world, for example, they'll say, you're complaining about us, but, you know, where's all this adaptation money that you've been promising for a very long time, you know, in the West? I mean, there is supposed to be, if you remember, $100 billion coming out of the West to help with adaptation. That really hasn't shown up either. So, you know, all around, there's been a complete lack of action and defensive posturing and all sorts of not particularly helpful stuff, unfortunately.
So what do you think will happen then on Wednesday night when Prime Minister Modi of India has dinner at the White House with President Obama? Obviously, he's not coming for the climate summit, but they are going to have dinner, and the president is going to be addressing the UN on Tuesday about this issue. That, I guess, in itself is the paradigm, right, of the developed versus developing, those two sitting down together?
I would suspect that the topic at dinner will have very, very little to do with climate change. There's a growing strategic shift within India with the new administration coming in There was an extremely successful visit by Modi to Japan, which produced about a $35 billion investment promise from Japan into things like infrastructure, high-speed rail, that sort of thing. And the engagement is specifically targeted, overtly targeted at Chinese containment. And that's because there's concern that the U.S., if there is trouble in the Pacific, the U.S. will not come and bail out Japan or South Korea or any of the other Philippines allies in the region. So Japan is looking to India as a solid strategic ally in the region. China's acknowledged that and countered with a visit by Xi Jinping just last week to India, where China's promised about $200 billion in various forms of engagement into India. So as India moves forward through this new strategic relationship within the Pacific that is very much Asia-focused, the U.S. is going to have to figure out how it's going to fit into that and how that affects its strategic alignment. So given those incredibly important changes that are happening at this very moment, I would suspect, unfortunately, climate change, which in itself will undermine a lot of that positioning but is not acknowledged, won't be brought to the table literally.
Again, I'm speaking with Claire Pascal, who specializes in the geopolitical security and economic implications of environmental change from global warming. She is a fellow at the Royal Institute of International Affairs, Chatham House, London, a consultant for the U.S. Department of Energy, NATO, and the OSCE, and was one of three recipients of the 2010 awards of special merit from the Grantham Prize for her book, Global Warring: How Environmental, Economic, and Political Crises Will Redraw the World Map. And you're there at the UN, Cleo Pascal. You've been working for a number of years on climate diplomacy in the Pacific and visiting these endangered Pacific islands where the sea level is rising because of global warming. Apparently, President Obama is going to announce some new initiatives for assisting the world's poorest countries, including these island nations already experiencing the devastation of sea level rises. What can you expect from him, and what do these islands want, since you spend so much time there talking to the leaders?
A lot of what they want is extremely basic. I mean, they want market access for their exports. They basically want to be economically viable and secure, which they're not at this moment, because once they have some economic security, they can make their own decisions. So in the case of Kiribati, for example, which is one of the countries that's greatly threatened by sea level rise, they know they're going to have to move some of their population, and they had enough economic security to buy some land in Fiji where they can initially grow food, which they can't really do domestically to the scale that they need anymore, and eventually potentially relocate. So what they need is financial viability at this moment so they can make their own decisions without having them forced upon them. The Australia-New Zealand relationship, economic relationship, has not worked out well. Hopefully, the U.S. will start with more economic engagement so that there can be more independence. At the moment, the country that's taken most advantage of the financial vulnerability of the countries of the Pacific has been China, which is moving in for its own strategic positioning reasons. So I would hope that the U.S. would start with this sort of economic engagement that can actually help create economic security, which can then help create actual security for the islands of the Pacific, as opposed to just saying, for example, you know, we'll give you one solar plant or something like that.
So when China moves into these Pacific island nations with gifts, what are the strings attached to the gifts?
There are all sorts of support for China's position, where whether it be at the United Nations for voting, for example. It can also be actual physical strategic positioning. So I know that China is very actively trying to get bases in many of these Pacific island countries. So far, they've been held back to a large degree. But if the countries become so unstable for environmental reasons and economic reasons, they're going to have no choice eventually but to give in to some of this pressure from China. Then, of course, there's the usual stuff about the Dalai Lama in Tibet and all of those other touchstone issues. But my biggest concern is that coming along with it is a large influx of Chinese population that may or may not have links back to the home country. And that population has been creating, this newly arrived population has been creating instability in some of the countries, including riots in the Solomons, riots in Tonga, and linkages to organized crime that's becoming socially destabilizing for many of the Pacific Island nations.
So, Claire Pascal, this UN summit is also expected to endorse a new international plan to cut deforestation in the world's tropical forest. Indonesia, of course, is being ravaged. Its rainforests are being cut down at an extraordinary rate and burned, and so much so that the smoke has closed down Singapore on a couple of occasions and polluted Malaysia to the point where people couldn't go outside. All this for palm oil. That's just one example. And I think India, if you look at the map, India used to be covered in forests 100 years ago, and it's down to very little. So this is a global inexorable trend. So what do you think can be done? Are there economic and market ways to get out of this? I mean, why? What's so important about palm oil if it's going to destroy the last little bits of the lungs of the earth?
I completely agree, and I hope that what they come up with creates the economic incentives to counterbalance that. We've seen a lot of organized crime associated with this sort of deforestation and exploitation of the local population. So along with alternative economic streams for the local populations who are obviously most directly affected, it's going to have to come with a buy-in from, in the case of Indonesia, for example, the military, who will then secure those regions and try to keep out criminal elements, some of whom themselves may have linkages into at least local politicians, in order to make sure that that happens. These are complex dynamics that involve solutions in many, many different societal and economic sectors. It's possible, and this is a very important first step to make it economically viable not to do this sort of thing. So hopefully that will come to fruition, but it will have to be with the buy-in of the militaries, police, judiciary of the countries that are involved.
Well, the one country that actually made some progress in terms of carbon pricing and carbon taxing was Australia. And then along comes this global warming denier who is now the Prime Minister, who is a Conservative, elected largely because the Labor Party was serial shooters in the foot. I mean, they absolutely behaved in a ridiculous and childish way, and the public got fed up with him. At a time of absolute prosperity, they escaped the big crash in 2008. The country was humming along, and yet this guy, his name is Abbott, came in with a large majority, and he's just wreaking havoc as fast as he can, dumping mining slurry on the Barrier Reef. He's basically entirely in the pocket of the mining lobby, who basically have become China's quarry. So where do we stand on that? That was, you know, Al Gore hailed that move in Australia as one of the great step forwards for mankind. Well, guess what? Mankind's just taken a step backwards.
Yeah, the problems within Australia are not just contained to Australia because of the dynamic that you're talking about, where China is buying, I think, about 30% of everything that Australia exports. And so you not only have the internal economic pressures, the big mining magnets funding the political parties directly for specific sorts of legislation, but also you have the external pressure of China not wanting any slowdown on the extraction of those resources and keeping those resources at a very low cost. So that internal economic and external political dynamic is increasingly coming into play in various aspects of Australia's policies, both domestic and foreign policy. And it raises questions about things like whether Australia is still a solid Western ally. If it is increasingly dancing to the economic tune played by China, can you trust Australia to be making decisions in the larger Pacific, in its sort of, you know, kind of domain, so to speak, of the Southern Pacific nations over which it pretends to be the big brother, that are in the best interests of the greater West, or will it be in the interests of Australia and the Australian economic interests that are aligned with China? So this question that you're bringing up is a critical question, because not only does it come into play just in terms of the carbon pricing, but in terms of Australia's general strategic positioning in a rapidly changing world.
But I bring it up because not just that there was one step taken forward and another one backwards, but that the whole idea that the country that's most affected by climate change, which is Australia, and it's so bad now in the interior, it gets so hot that the kangaroos can't stand it, that they would vote in a prime minister who's a global warming denier when they have evidence, you know, fires, bushfires, insufferable heat, you name it.
Yeah, I mean, it's economically suicidal, and part of that comes down to, you know, the message that's getting out within Australia. There's a certain issue with media ownership within Australia.
There you have it. Now. Do you realize that, Claire, this is a pop quiz. Who is the second biggest investor in News Corporation, the Murdoch family's news monopoly around the world?
Tell me.
The Kingdom Fund, which is the sovereign fund of Saudi Arabia's royal family, the Al Sauds.
Oh, there you go.
So do you think they have an incentive in pretending that global warming doesn't exist?
Yeah. So it's not, it sadly tends not to be that complicated. But my argument is that even if you're acting in narrow self-interest, this is not going to help you. As you say, the economic situation in Australia may seem to benefit in the short term by this sort of massive extraction and the cutting of any sorts of restraints, but actually, as you say, it is destroying the country, and it is increasingly transferring these costs onto the average Australian with increasing insurance costs, problems with water. It's going to wipe out large sections of the agricultural sector with this increasing drought. There's a problem with the coastal cities. So, you know, if you think you're actually being brutally self-interested, then you should get behind trying to mitigate and adapt for climate change. You shouldn't be blocking it. If you're blocking it, you may be making money today, but by this afternoon, you're going to be going bankrupt.
So just in closing then, does this mean that this is a struggle between anti-intellectualism and reality? Because, for example, the House is just holding hearings on the EPA's ability to monitor greenhouse gases from stationary power sources. The chairman of the House committee that's excoriating the EPA is a global warming denier, and he's a Republican. The Republicans are likely to gain seats in the next election. So what's happening to the world in terms of the gray matter? Are smart people falling asleep at the switch and stupid people taking over?
People tend to act in a smart way over what they think is in their self-interest. So I don't think necessarily they're not smart people. I think they might think that they're being very clever and ensuring funding for re-election or things like that. I think the problem comes when the people who are funding them actually don't realize that their own interests will be compromised. This is not a far-off island sinking in the Pacific. This is a complete strategic realignment which might undermine their entire economic security. So if you think you're being clever by blocking this so that you can make some short-term economic gain, over the long term, including the energy sector, you will get damaged. Your power stations will be increasingly knocked out by storm activity. Your nuclear stations won't have enough water to function. Your pipelines that are built on permafrost will become increasingly unstable. So the lack of imagination is coming more in the context of the energy producers who think they're being clever but actually don't understand the realities and how it will affect them and their economic interests in the long run and even the medium run.
Well, Claire Pascal, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Great pleasure. Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Claire Pascal, who specializes in the geopolitical security and economic implications of climate change from global warming. She's a fellow at the Royal Institute of International Affairs, Chatham House, London, a consultant to the United States Department of Energy, NATO, and the OSCE, and was one of three recipients of the 2010 Awards of Special Merit from the Grantham Prize for her book, Global Warring, How Environmental, Economic, and Political Crises Will Redraw the World Map. We're going to take a brief station break, and we're back looking into how the Koch brothers are buying up America's universities. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Connor Gibson, a member of Greenpeace's investigations team, where he focuses on polluting industries and their front groups, PR firms and political operatives. He is the author of Greenpeace's new report, Coke Pollution on Campus, Academic Freedom Under Assault, from Charles Koch's $50 million campaign to infiltrate higher education. Welcome to Background Briefing, Connor Gibson.
Thank you, Ian.
And apparently Charles Koch is spending $50 million donating it to 254 U.S. and Canadian institutions of higher education. And this means that Koch's investments in universities have skyrocketed in recent years from just seven schools in 2005 to about 250 schools today. So what is their agenda or strategy here?
Well, Charles Koch is very interested in his long-term political plan, and the universities are actually the first step that the Koch brothers use to influence politics and culture, often in favor of their own business interests. So they start by cranking out ideas at the university institutions they fund, which are then transformed into policy options at the think tanks they're bankrolling, and then they have their advocacy organizations like Americans for Prosperity advocate for the policies that they have transformed from those institutions. This is all laid out by Richard Fink, who is a longtime right-hand man of Charles Koch. He calls it the structure of social change. So the $50 million that Charles Koch has sent to these 254 universities over the last several years is often to cultivate the intellectual ammunition for his political agenda, but as well as recruiting students into his political network.
But apparently this money comes with strings attached, does it not?
Yes, the Koch grants, by all expert opinion, the American Association of University Professors say Charles Koch's grants are very much a threat to academic freedom. He gets control over which kinds of professors are hired, either with explicit restrictions in the contract language or by more subtle language that ensures the right kind of people are hired. They make it clear they'll pull their funding if you don't hire a professor that's willing to teach, say, economic freedom. And economic freedom is a concept that the Kochs create, actually, with Florida State University professors and a think tank in Canada called the Fraser Institute. It's a way of measuring world economies in a way that's very favorable to the types of anti-regulatory, low-tax business plan that has made Charles Koch rich. So, you know, Charles Koch also funds clubs where they have to read his book, The Science of Success. There are professors involved in denying the science of climate change well outside of their field of credentialed expertise. So there's a lot to be concerned about in terms of what Koch's agenda is doing to the concept of academic freedom and when his interests are not aligning with students who just need to be educated.
So this idea of economic freedom, it does appear to be incredibly self-serving. I mean, whose economic freedom are we talking about? It's the Koch brothers' economic freedom, is it not? How does that concept translate into any kind of recognized academic economics course?
Well, that's the part that's a little more difficult to prove, and I think that's where the relationships they develop with the professors and the deans of these economics and business departments really help make sure the right folks get in that understand what economic freedom, wink, wink, means, or the science of human action is another buzzword you'll hear them say. That kind of just describes the Koch brothers' agenda. And again, this is the agenda that has made them rather wealthy, remembering that they were born into millions of dollars from their father's fortune from his oil business. And Charles Koch has certainly ballooned his wealth beyond that. I wouldn't pretend that he hasn't made himself into the man that's now worth $40 to $50 billion, depending on which estimate you go with. But, you know, the reality is that these policies often roll back, you know, regulations that protect us from pollution, that protect human health by not allowing corporations to just dump toxins into the environment or, you know, emit greenhouse gases at an unchecked rate. And that's very self-serving to a company like Koch Industries at the expense of most people.
Well, what I find interesting about this is how the academics who are getting this money are sort of conflicted in a kind of weaselly kind of way, is the only way I can put it. In the case of the Florida State University that you mentioned, where the Koch brothers donated millions of dollars to set up a libertarian kind of economics department, the chairman of the economics department, Bruce Benson, told his colleagues, quoting, "The reality is that we live and work in an environment that is subject to all sorts of political manipulations. we are not going to be able to hire anybody for the funded program if we do not work out an acceptable arrangement with Koch and its funding partners. So they're basically, you know, he sort of makes a nod to academic freedom on the one hand, but he is also saying, as we all know, there are no free lunches. So it's a sort of capitulation in terms of academic freedom, which they're openly acknowledging.
That's exactly right. And I would say those emails were published last week by the Center for Public Integrity. A reporter named Dave Leventhal got a hold of them. And Bruce Benson, that economics chair at Florida State University, made it very clear what the, quote, ethical and moral dilemmas would be with this contract they were signing with the Kochs. The other thing that's incredible is a PhD student at Florida State who was working under that man who was negotiating the Koch contract. This PhD student was named Matt Brown. He was on the Koch Foundation payroll. He was paid $549,000 from 2007 to 2009 as he was helping the Koch Foundation negotiate with Florida State. I would say, you know, that financial incentive had a lot to do with them getting their foot in the door at Florida State University, and that has gone largely unreported, but it's written right there in the Charles Koch Foundation tax forms.
So let's turn then to the Arizona State example. Again, it's dressed up as freedom. Freedom is a word that the Kochs use a lot. But again, there is such a self-serving aspect to this. It feels incredibly cynical. And, you know, it just feels like there are a bunch of academic whores out there that are just only too willing to be bought.
I think maybe that might be part of the case, but it's also, there's a reality that universities are, their funding publicly is drying up, and when a university is publicly funded, they're only accountable to the public. But the problem is, no thanks to campaigns waged by folks like Charles and David Koch and the political network they fund, public funding for higher education institutions is drying up. When they cut the budget of a state, when they cut corporate income taxes to benefit companies like theirs, that means there's less money out there for universities, and who do they have to turn to for their funding? Private donors. And then it turns out the Koch brothers and others like them are walking in, you know, offering grants with very specific strings attached. So there is kind of a more, a darker reality to the need of these universities to solicit private donors for funding.
But this is very similar, though, to the sort of bait-and-switch strategy of Rand Paul. Rand Paul is going on campuses, winning over a lot of students and liberal students, too, you know, traditionally, or not, at least going back to the 60s, it was always thought that student bodies were dominated by liberals, you know, particularly during the anti-Vietnam War era. But so what seems to be happening with Rand Paul is that he's sort of wooing these students by saying he's in favor of legalizing pot and against foreign wars. But at the same time, he doesn't stress his economic plan, which is to hand over the United States economy and the government to the Koch brothers. They actually don't believe in anything that the government does. And that seems to be also the MO of the Kochs, is it? I mean, they talk about freedom and they're against crony capitalism. But at the end of the day, they just want to weaken the government to the point where it's become irrelevant. And they dominate our politics, our economy, and they're free to destroy our environment.
That's exactly right. I would say that, you know, the Koch brothers, it's interesting you mentioned crony capitalism and corporate cronyism. These are buzzwords that Charles has tossed out there in his Wall Street Journal editorials and other places. You know, the Koch brothers aren't actually pure libertarians. You mentioned them funding libertarian causes on campus. I would say their alliance with libertarians at this point is shaky at best. While they came up as incubators of the libertarian movement, they've really strayed farther into mainstream politics that are self-serving, which is completely against Charles Koch's rhetoric. You know, he is increasingly more interested in bending government in the favor of the things that he believes are important. So, you know, Charles Koch is, I would argue, not really a libertarian. If you read Sons of Wichita, the first biography on the Koch brothers that Daniel Shulman just wrote, you'll see that they have a history of systematically, according to some Koch employees, violating environmental laws, making, you know, purposely not investing in safety improvements on their pipelines because it was all incentivizing employees to make as much profit as possible. And they didn't take the time to update security. And that resulted in pipeline explosions, pipeline leaks. People died in some of these accidents. So Koch itself, you know, is not libertarian purists, I would say. They've strayed to be much more self-serving. And I think a lot of libertarians would be frustrated with that.
Well, apparently, though, Charles Koch was very influenced by the Lewis Powell memo, which many people cite as the beginning of this new era of the corporatization of our politics. And as we know, the Supreme Court now is dominated by corporatists who brought us the extraordinary campaign finance ruling on Citizens United. So he mentions this Powell memo, Lewis Powell, who later became a Supreme Court justice. He was on the boards of major U.S. corporations, and he wrote a memo to the U.S. Chamber of Commerce back in 1971 at the height of the anti-Vietnam War era, where the sort of corporate establishment were panicking, thinking that these long-haired, dope-smoking, free-loving students were going to be the future of America, and that you wouldn't be able to find any button-down young men and ladies to enter the corporate realm. And since then, they've organized think tanks and the media and the courts and now, as we're talking here, education, to basically spread, you know, the corporate line, and they've been incredibly successful.
That's right. In fact, Charles Koch himself took the Lewis Powell memo directly to heart. One of the things we published in our report yesterday, which was first published in part by the New York Times, but they didn't actually write about this part of the memo. Charles Koch has been the chairman of a group called the Institute for Humane Studies for decades now. And the Institute for Humane Studies is an organization that's on the campus of George Mason University, right outside Washington, D.C. Now, this university, its foundation depends on Koch Brothers grants for 15% of its income over the last few years. So Charles Koch has the Institute for Humane Studies on campus. In 1974, he gave a speech to the board of directors of that organization. And he said, we should cease financing our own destruction by supporting only those programs, departments, or schools that contribute in some way to our individual companies or to the general welfare of our free enterprise system. So straight from the horse's mouth, that's Charles Koch saying, we should only fund schools if they're going to advance our business interests. He continues to be the chairman of the Institute for Humane Studies, and that is the organization that recruit students into paid internships with housing stipends at the think tanks that Charles Koch bankrolls. These are the same think tanks that are attacking labor rights, attacking minimum wage laws, denying the science of climate change, attacking clean energy competition to companies like Koch Industries. So, you know, this is very much a sophisticated plan, and Charles Koch has been at it for decades now.
And isn't George Mason University also where the Mercatus Center is?
That's right. The Mercatus Center is another organization that Charles Koch put up the money to start. And again, his right-hand man, Richard Fink, Koch Industries executive, is the president of the Mercatus Center. It still is. That is also at George Mason University. That is mainly a organization that works with graduate students to crank out studies that often have a very anti-regulatory take on things. They published a hit list of regulations that was taken up by the George W. Bush administration in large part, going after the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency. You know, these are the types of conflicts of interest I'm talking about when you have a oil refining and piping company like Koch Industries bankrolling causes and founding organizations that attack environmental regulations that would affect that company.
The Congress at the moment is having a hearing into the EPA's plan to regulate fossil fuel power plants and the CO2 that they generate. The biggest source comes from coal-fired plants. The chairman of this House committee, Congressman Lamar Smith of Texas, is a global warming denier. And here he is holding hearings to beat up on the EPA over their right, which the Supreme Court upheld under the Clean Air Act, to regulate CO2. Lamar Smith and most of the Republicans on the House Science Committee are unbelievable ignoramuses who deny science, who are anti-intellectual, and talk in terms of biblical truths as opposed to scientific truths. And so how does academia get into bed with the same kind of people that the Koch brothers are fronting and funding in Congress to do their bidding, the Lamar Smiths? I mean, I thought academics had to at least acknowledge intellectual honesty.
Well, you would think that, but, you know, these politicians are, you know, most people know politicians don't have a reputation for being honest. They have a reputation for, you know, advancing the interests of those that they most rely upon in order to kind of stay in office or positions of power. That's a bit of an oversimplistic characterization, but that's like the general understanding that we have. Somebody like Lamar Smith is funded by Koch Industries, in fact. This man has received hundreds of thousands of dollars from oil and coal companies over the last decade. But, you know, these politicians, in order to be able to say some of the the very strange and false things that they say, such as undermining the science of climate change when there's 97% consensus among actual climate experts and scientists out there. They need an intellectual framework to stand on, and they need the culture of the country to be ripe for receiving that kind of message. And the Koch brothers, by bankrolling these universities, by having economics professors teach their students that climate change isn't real, by cranking out studies that their think tanks can rely upon, and then that there are organizations like Americans for Prosperity can run false advertisements around political elections. You know, this is a multifaceted way to create the culture in this country that can still keep electing somebody that, you know, denies basic science and many of the other bizarre things that we hear coming out of the mouths of politicians.
But again, I don't understand how academics can accept pseudoscience and anti-intellectualism. It seems to be inherently a contradiction.
Yeah, for some of these people, I honestly could not begin to tell you what the motivation is. I'm sure money for some, but, you know, a lot of folks, there's a conspiratorial predisposition to accepting the science of climate change. You know, this is a lot of folks responding to a public relations campaign put on by the coal and oil industries for decades now to fabricate doubt, and that's straight out of the playbook of the tobacco industry. So even some intellectuals at universities who maybe the money isn't a temptation have a certain worldview that this notion somehow that scientists are engaged in a global conspiracy to over control people's lives, rather than the reality of scientists being, you know, very concerned about the impact this is going to have on people, especially poor people. That's just something that is a bizarre side effect of the culture in our time.
Yeah, but not only that, scientists are incredibly conservative. They don't make rash and radical statements. They only back up what they say with laborious research. So they're by nature incredibly conservative. So that's another contradiction.
It is indeed a contradiction. And within the scientific community, you will find very, very few who disagree with the reality of climate change and the mountains of evidence that have been accumulating for decades now on the research of humans causing climate change. But, you know, that the in the public eye, which is what the political world responds to, you know, if you can get TV debates where there's one scientist and one industry-funded climate change denier who's not saying who they're representing, then it looks like a 50-50 debate, and that has taken this conversation, you know, down to depths that you couldn't have imagined. And again, this is borrowing from the tobacco industry's playbook to manufacture doubt as a product in terms of denying that cigarettes were giving people cancer. And the oil and coal industry took the same tactic to heart. The Koch brothers bankrolling a vast majority of the organizations responsible for that work.
And, of course, our press convention that there's an equal and opposite argument on every issue has given these climate deniers a platform and respectability that they don't deserve, along with equating creationism with evolution, so that you can blame the press for that as well. I thank you for joining us, Connor Gibson.
Thank you so much, Ian.
Again, I've been speaking with Connor Gibson, who's a member of Greenpeace's investigations team, where he focuses on polluting industry and their front groups, PR firms, and political operatives. He is the author of Greenpeace's new report, Koch Pollution on Campus, Academic Freedom Under Assault from Charles Koch's $50 million campaign to infiltrate higher education. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me and scroll down on the right-hand side and sign up for iTunes podcast. And I'll be back again tomorrow at 5 p.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.